Home with the Hogs with Mr. and Mrs. Hogg.
Well, hello, good morning, and welcome home with the Hogs to the third in the trinity of our live Christmas programmes here on Talk Radio Europe's Saturday magazine show. I'm Kit, and sadly, no Heifer this morning. Instead, she sent her only begotten son, Coy, who is my co-presenter today. Coy, be hi and welcome.
Good morning.
And as is fashionable at this time of indulgence, we talk about health, nutrition and essential fitness, which you are actually qualified to do, aren't you? You're not just a talking head with a pretty face.
Yeah.
So tell us, how are you qualified?
I'm qualified in, I'd say, fitness and general health coaching. I do CrossFit coaching in Barcelona, and today we're going to be talking to Gillian Bennett, who is a nutrition coach, and is going to talk to us about how to tackle the new year and affront New Year's resolutions.
Ooh, that's Gillian Bennett with Coyby, not just one, but two CrossFit personal expert trainer coaches.
Coaches.
On your case in just 5 minutes from now. Our political correspondent, Matthew Bennett, joins us at about 25 minutes before midday for a review of 2018, some interesting trends that have shaped the political landscape here in Spain. And in the second hour of the show, we look forward to the company of Matthew Wolfman, an analog man, not only with some digitally challenging Christmas presents. It's all happening, of course, here at Home for the Hogs. But he's also got a short story for Saturday. So that's Matthew Wolfman in the second hour. More than compelling evidence for you to embrace your radio for the next 2 hours here at
Home with the Hogs with Mr. and Mrs. Hogg.
TRE. Talk Radio Europe.
TRE. At Home with the Hogs.
And welcome back. Now, I have to tell you a little story before we speak to our first guest, because, well, by way of introduction, really, curious thing happened to me on my way to the studio this morning, popping into the supermarket Maxi Gear for an item of shopping. I was met by a woman in full flight with a large bag of shopping who was exiting the building, pursued by four other women who were Maxi Gear employees, including the woman from behind the meat counter, who I think was brandishing a meat cleaver. I may have been imagining that. But by the time I was at the checkout, like some 2 minutes later, the vigilante party had returned, breathing heavily, the breath of defeat, I'm afraid. The shoplifter had got away, outpaced them in spite of her heavy bag of stolen shopping. Two lessons here. One, don't ever underestimate the loyalty and motivation of Maxi Gear employees, who I thought were a pretty hopeless lot, you know. And two, they're not fit enough to catch a middle-aged woman laden with goods. So it's fitness now that we want to talk about, and new regimes for 2019. CrossFit and nutrition coach, native of California, resident in Barcelona, Gillian Bennett joins us on the phone. Gillian, hi, good morning to you.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
Very well. Nice of you to join us. You're actually in Liverpool today, yeah?
I am. I'm in Liverpool this morning. It has currently stopped raining, which is surprising.
Good.
And it looks like we might have a nice day.
Cool. Gillian, good morning. And we're going to talk a little bit about what you do. You say that you are a nutrition coach. What does that actually mean?
So basically, what a nutrition coach does and what I do is I work with people to define what their goals are in relation to nutrition and health. And then we work on sort of creating habits that are going to get them to those goals. So it's not like do this and you'll succeed. It's more like do this, but let's understand why you're doing it, the reasons behind it, and that I find that that really helps with motivation and also helps people stay on track because they really understand a bit more of the whole process behind the nutrition process.
So hold on. So basically, you're a nutritionist, right?
So I don't call myself a nutritionist. Generally, what nutritionists do is they give diets or they give meal plans. They might sit down with someone for 30 minutes or so. You know, they take some measurements and then they say, "All right, see you later." What happens then is people are given this meal plan or this diet, and they know that in order, you know, if X then if X then Y, if they follow the diet plan, they'll lose weight or gain muscle or whatever. But they don't understand why these food items are on it or why they're choosing, you know, white fish over beef or chicken over the ham. They don't really understand what it is that they're doing to improve their health. They just know that if I do this, then I should reach these goals.
So, Gillian, what you're offering them is a basis of understanding rather than just a regimen.
Exactly. So I find that what works a lot better is if someone understands why they're doing something, they become a lot more invested in the process.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing with nutrition is it's something that we need to eat for the rest of our lives. So I would much rather teach someone how to do it themselves. So I imagine that most of my clients don't want to keep paying me until they die.
Right. So with that in mind, it's New Year's coming up and it's the time of year where everyone's making New Year's resolutions. Some of them are quite extreme, others start going to the gym, but a lot of them are actually to do with diets. Do you have any New Year's resolutions yourself?
So I'm not a big fan of resolutions. I tend to actually, for the last almost 10 years, I've set goals every year because I find that with a goal, you can look at, okay, I would like to get here. And then I can break it down into the little steps or sort of habits, so to speak, in order to get to those goals rather than saying, I'm going to go to the gym every day. And then, you know, that never happens.
Okay, well, give us an example of a goal.
A nutrition goal or just a general?
No, a nutrition goal, because it's nutrition that we're talking about. Say over a period of 12 months, over 2019, that may not necessarily pertain to you, but might pertain to one of our listeners, for example.
Okay. So a good one, you know, most people, what they want to do is, you know, they start the new year and they say, I want to lose 5 kilos. Okay. So look at that and say, let's rephrase it. I will lose 5 kilos by December 2019. Okay, so what does that mean? That means that I should be losing a little bit less than half a kilo a month. So what steps can I take then to get closer to that goal? So that may be, okay, I will set a goal of walking an extra 1,000 steps a day, 2,000 steps a day. I will eat a salad before every lunch and dinner meal. So it's finding ways to make it more specific. And that way you can actually gauge at the end of the day, did I complete that mini goal for the day? And each day you're getting closer to the ultimate goal of losing 5 kilos.
So someone could come to you with a goal like that, Gillian, and you would give them, well, A, I understand that you would give them an understanding of whether it's real or not, their particular goal, whether it's a realistic mm-hmm. objective, and B, that you would give them a path on which to tread, a camino, so to speak.
Exactly. So we would look at what it is that they're trying to achieve, also why they're trying to achieve it, because that is really important when it comes to motivation. And then look at things that they can do every single day in order to direct them towards that goal.
Right. So also around this time of year, people start talking about detoxing after the Christmas mm-hmm. feasts and stuff. Do you believe in that? What's your opinion on
detoxing? Yeah, detox is huge.
Are you
down
detoxing?
Here. Yeah. The Costa del Sol is detox central. Sorry
I
to
interrupt. I love this question because your body is actually built to detox itself. So that's essentially the purpose of your liver.
Oh, so we can just keep drinking as much as we want.
What if we keep poisoning ourselves?
Well, no, but there are ways to do, quote unquote, a detox without, you know, only drinking juice for a week, because that's actually not really helpful to your overall health. If someone were to come to me and say, I'd like to do a detox, you know, I've been drinking and eating like crazy since December 1st, and I need to detox my body, I would recommend that they cut completely down on processed food and really focus on eating a lot of high-quality fruits and vegetables, lean protein sources. So instead of saying, I'm going to eat a fish finger, I would say, why don't you get a fish fillet and make that yourself? So sort of taking their food down to the ingredient level rather than the product level.
And what would you stop doing as part of a detox? Does it necessarily involve cutting out alcohol?
I would recommend cutting out alcohol. Definitely, you know, people always ask me, like, can I lose weight and still drink alcohol? And the answer is yes, you definitely can, and you can be healthy and drink alcohol. However, you will be healthier and you will lose more weight, or you will be more successful in your goals if you do limit the alcohol intake.
Right. So with these in mind, and with detoxing and New Year's resolutions, if people are looking to make some kind of change, what would be your top, say, let's say three tips for someone to pick up on or to start being conscious of their nutrition? Top three tips for the year.
I think for someone that's just sort of on a basic level of nutrition understanding, there's some really easy ways that you can almost like trick yourself into eating healthier without really getting too in depth. My first one would, I mean, anybody that knows me is probably sick of hearing me talk about vegetables. So my first tip would just be to eat vegetables first. And part of that, it might sound a little bit silly or a little bit overly simple, but if you're trying to improve your nutrition, that probably means you're trying to cut down on things you know aren't good for you. And so if you're filling up with vegetables before you eat everything else in your meal, or if you're choosing vegetables or even fruit as a snack, then you're probably going to be just naturally eating less of those things that you're trying to cut out of your diet without really trying to.
Right. So you're saying, if I've got a plate of food and I've got some chips and a steak and some veggies, I want to hit the veggies first.
Definitely.
Right.
And especially, you know, if you've got a big plate of food, and you, even if you, you know, you're the type of person that maybe generally doesn't finish all your food, well, if you start with your vegetables, you might end up leaving some chips on the plate. So there you've naturally just cut down on the caloric value of your meal, and you've increased the nutrient level. So you're winning already.
Yeah. One thing I try and do, this is resonant with something I try and do sometimes, is eat fruit before a meal.
So I think that can be a really good choice. And I definitely, you know, if it's a choice between I'm going to eat fruit as a snack before a meal rather than, you know, crisps, great. I find that I tend to go more towards vegetables just because people tend to eat way less vegetables than they do fruit. Mm-hmm. And so if you can start increasing your vegetable intake, then that is a great way to cut down on your caloric intake and a great way to up the vitamins and minerals that you're taking in every day. Because fruit tends to be a much easier one for people to start including.
Why are vegetables so much better than fruit then?
I don't see that vegetables are better than fruit. But the fact of the matter is that fruit does contain fruit sugar. It's obviously not the same thing as eating a spoonful of table sugar. But as far as raising levels of sugar in your levels of blood sugar, it does have an impact. And fruit tends to be more caloric than vegetables. You can eat a lot more vegetables than fruit for the same caloric value. And then as far as health, both of them contribute a ton of vitamins and minerals. But as I said, it's more common for people to eat more fruit. So the vitamins and minerals that we find in veggies tend to be lacking in a lot of people's diet.
Right. Okay, so we've got eat your vegetables first. That's your first handy tip.
Yes.
The next one, Jillian, what is it?
Next one, also super simple. First thing in the morning, everybody does the same thing. Everybody wakes up and they go straight to the bathroom and they go pee. Right after that, my recommendation is to drink a big, big glass of water.
What, before coffee?
Before coffee. I know, and I'm a huge...
That's really hard.
...to go right towards coffee. But train yourself. Make this a habit. First thing in the morning, giant glass of water.
Do you do that? Genuinely?
I do that.
Before coffee?
I do. And actually, so I'm in Liverpool staying at my grandparents, and it's sort of a joke in the family because I'll walk in, and I won't actually be able to talk to anyone until I've had my water.
Because your mouth is so dry, or... Yeah, no, I do know what you mean. I do know what you mean. I've been waking up with a very dry mouth recently. And what I tend to do is blunder into the kitchen and put on the percolator. And so I'm going to try and do that. Yep.
Especially in winter. Yeah. I find in winter I don't drink any water. I just don't drink any water.
Also what happens is a lot of people tend to keep their water in the fridge. I hate cold water, especially in winter. And so if you keep maybe a jug of water on the counter so it's room temperature, makes it a lot easier to drink a lot of it.
Right. So we've got eat your vegetables first, drink a pint of water before coffee, after having a pee. What's the third tip?
Read your ingredient labels. Start familiarizing yourself with what it is that you're buying and you're eating. I mean, ideally, obviously, in the perfect world, everybody would be eating, you know, locally grown vegetables and grass-fed meats and wild-raised fish or wild-caught fish, but that's not realistic for most people. So just start reading. If you're buying food products, you know, anything that comes in a package, start reading what's in that package.
Yeah.
Generally, if you read something and you're like, well, I don't know what that is, your body's probably having the same reaction when you eat it.
Like Pringles.
So Pringles, I mean, Pringles are a food-like product. It's not really food.
It's like just matter, isn't it? It's just potato matter.
Yeah, it's potato-shaped solids, isn't it? Well, they're not even potato-shaped.
I don't even know if you read Pringles. I don't even know if potatoes are the first ingredient.
Yeah, they're a bit eerie, Pringles, aren't they?
Yeah.
So great. So we've got those three handy tips. That's very succinct, easy to remember. Eat your vegetables first. Drink a cup of water, a big cup of glass of water in the morning before you have coffee. Really hard, that one. And read the ingredient labels. And you shouldn't have more than, what, five ingredients on anything that you're going to buy. Well, the fewer ingredients, the better. I mean, here's broccoli, exactly. And what's in this is only broccoli. There's nothing else. Okay, that's good. But a Pringle has sort of about 18 ingredients, most of which begin with E. Don't trust it.
Steer away.
Exactly. If you get bored before finishing the ingredient label, it's probably a bad thing for you to be eating.
All right. So, Jillian, if people want to get in touch with you and maybe talk about some New Year's resolutions and some goals to set for the new year, how are they going to get in touch with you?
Oh, nutrition in general,
Do they? Was it Jillian Bennett?
Yep. So I try to post useful tips and photos and recipes. Even sometimes I'll post some workouts on my Instagram page, and that is bite.size.nutrition on Instagram. I'm also bite-sized pieces. I believe it's bite-sized pieces nutrition on Facebook. And then you can send me an email if you are so inclined at bitesizepiece@gmail.com.
Right. So we've got bite.size.nutrition on Instagram, bite-sized pieces on Facebook, and the email address is, what was it?
bitesizepiece@gmail.com.
Wicked. Thank you very much.
And then, thank you. Well, just a quick thing. Also, very soon to come, bitesizepieces.es, where I will be blogging, posting in nutrition information, and also will be taking on clients through my website.
Kiel, just a last question. Do you enjoy food? Would you describe yourself as a foodie?
I love food.
Good.
I love food.
That's great.
What's your favorite snack?
My favorite snack? I would say if I've got time, I love baked sweet potato with an over-easy egg, so like a runny egg.
Ooh, well, I love a baked
that's,
sweet
that
potato.
That is not a snack. Yeah. That's like a full-on meal. You got a that's a half an hour prep time.
Yeah, well, you're sort of talking about a Pringle equivalent, yeah.
Then probably if we're going for something really, really easy, maybe hard-boiled egg or a couple pieces of smoked salmon on a rice cake. Sometimes I'll just eat bell peppers, just plain bell peppers.
As an apple?
Carrots. Yeah, like an apple.
Yeah, Gillian, it's been great having you on the program, and really interesting. And we wish you a very happy new year.
Thank you. You as well. Thanks so much.
Yeah, and we hope we speak to you again.
All right. Great. Thank you.
Okay. Take care now. Bye-bye.
Bye.
That's Gillian Bennett, and talking to us from Liverpool. Bitesizednutrition.com?
Bitesizednutrition. If you're going to search for it on Instagram, it will be bite.size.nutrition.
Terrific.
Facebook is bite-sized pieces.
Okay, so nutrition is part of the program, but the reason those women couldn't catch the shoplifter in Maxidia is that they simply weren't fit enough. They ran out of puff. Koibi, give us four exercises that we can do. We're not accustomed to exercising, particularly, that we can take into our homes and we can do as part of a morning routine or a routine at any time of day. Four essential exercises. What would you recommend?
So your four key exercises for the coming year and for actually all your life you should be doing.
And if you want to call in, by the way, and join in the discussion, please do 952-78-4000 for talking about exercise and nutrition for the next 10 minutes or so.
So we've got the first exercise and the key exercise that everyone should be able to do. If you can't do this movement, then train it, is the squat. Squat is fundamental for standing up, sitting down, getting off the ground, the strength in your legs, and also your midline stabilization. And if I'm talking about that, it means how do you control your core when the rest of your body is moving.
So the key to squatting is keeping your heels on the floor, am I right?
So a squat, you want to open out your legs so they're just shoulder width apart, your feet. Push your knees out, try and separate the ground underneath your feet. I imagine there's a crack in the ground and you're trying to open that out. That will keep your knees pointing in the right direction. And then your butt comes back, so your hips are coming backwards, keeping your weight on your heels. Come down to 90 degrees or lower if you can, and then come straight back up. Make sure you keep your back straight during the whole movement. That's your first fundamental movement.
Okay, we got
movement.
Squat, yep.
Second fundamental movement is going to be a push-up. And it's important to note that you can do any variation of the push-up. A lot of people can't actually do a strict push-up, meaning that you've got your toes on the ground and your elbows from full lock. You come down to the ground, touch your chest on the ground, and then push back up to a full lock position again. If that's too hard, what you can do is, firstly, as you're starting to lower down from that position, you put your knees on the ground, then your hips come down, and then your chest comes down.
You're basically your points of contact are your knees instead of your feet.
Your knees and then your hips, because sometimes knees is actually too heavy for some people as well. The important thing is you maintain a good mechanic of the movement. If you keep your knees on the ground, a lot of the time what you get is your hips start sagging, and you want to kind of keep your lumbar spine, your back straight again. So it's for all exercises, you want to keep your back straight, really. And then you come up in the similar direction. So if you imagine you're kind of like a slinky or a snake, you can come down, touch your knees, then your hips, then your chest, and come back in the same way. And pretty much everyone, unless you've got a wrist injury, you should be able to do some form of a push-up. So get stronger in that movement as well. The next movement is going to be a lunge. So it's your second leg movement, which is similar to a squat in that it's a leg movement, but it's going to work a little bit more in your stability with a single leg because you're lunging forward or lunging backwards. If you've got knee problems, make sure you lunge backwards or a reverse lunge. So don't lunge forward because that puts quite a lot of pressure on the front side of the knee. And this is going to work your stability on one leg. And also it's going to help out your glutes. So your bum and your hamstrings a little bit more, which are the muscles on the back side of your leg. And my last exercise would be the plank. The plank is, how would you describe a plank? You're on your forearms and your toes are touching the ground and you're maintaining a straight body position. So a straight line from your heel to the top of your shoulder, without your hips sagging in the middle. Really important that.
And this is an abdominal exercise, actually, isn't it?
Well,
this is replacing sit-ups, because I'm surprised you haven't got sit-ups on this list.
Yeah, sit-ups are actually... I mean, sit-ups became a fashion in kind of the 80s for bodybuilding to try and get chiseled abs, which is all very well, but it's not actually a desperately fundamental kind of functional movement. Because when... I mean, how often do you really do a sit-up in everyday life?
I think it's quite important to be able to sit up.
How? Like when? Like when you're...
Well, getting out of the bath, for example. Getting out of bed, even
all right,
sitting
up in bed. I propose to you that you would do actually more abdominal exercise doing a plank, because you're stabilizing, you're having to stabilize your whole body and keeping yourself straight. What the abdominals actually do, they're stabilizing muscles. So it's to help with your posture, it's to help with when you're standing up, sitting down, doing any kind of movement. You want to brace your abdominal area. And it's not only, we're not only talking about the abdomen, we're also talking about the lumbar spine. So your spinal erectors, which are just above your glutes, and keeping yourself upright. So,
okay.
Yeah, we've got a squat, a push-up, a lunge
and a plank. Now, you were also talking to me last night about a stretch called the posterior. Describe that briefly.
Well, the stretch, you can be creative with your stretching and kind of do what you feel during that day. But I would definitely suggest stretching your posterior chain.
Okay, now this is about back pain, isn't it? Which lots of us suffer from.
Yes,
back pain.
Yeah. So the posterior chain, without it sounding too kind of, you know, uppity, because it's called, it's got a fancy name. Basically, it's your lower back, your bum, and your hamstrings. Your hamstrings are the muscles on the backs of your legs. And when your posterior chain gets tight, so if your hamstrings get tight, your glutes will then get tight, and it will put a lot of pressure on your lower back. So if you wake up in the morning and you've got back pain, which I do sometimes after playing rugby or doing a heavy gym session, what I do is I try and stretch out my glutes and I try and stretch out my hamstrings, and the back pain disappears. It's amazing. So make sure you're stretching your posterior chain.
Wicked. We've got a caller on the line. Hi, good morning. You're live at Home with the Hogs.
Yes, hello, good morning and Happy New Year to you all.
And to you.
If I can ask a question to your bright young son.
You can.
If we do that routine that you just said, would you just do one set of each, or would you do sets, and would you, how many reps would you recommend kicking it all off with?
So I would say, in terms of your reps and your sets that you're going to do, because they're working different parts of the body, you could put them into a circuit training. So you've got, imagine you're going to do four rounds, so four sets of each exercise, and in each exercise do between 8 to 12 reps to start off with.
Okay.
So it means you can go from the squat, you can go pretty much directly into the push-up, because you're working different muscle groups.
Right.
And then from the push-up, you can go directly into the lunge. Again, it's different muscle groups, and then onto the plank at the end. So then once you do a full round of it, you're probably going to want to rest for a couple of minutes.
Yep.
Before starting again. And as you progress, as you get better, you can start adding reps, adding sets, getting rid of rest, and start mixing it up a little bit.
Great. Thank you for your help. It's really lovely to hear all this stuff. Thank you.
Okay, no worries. Good luck with it, man. Have a fit new year.
You too.
Bye-bye now. Kobe, before we leave this section, could you tell us about the magical cure for back pain?
The magical cure.
Without being lewd, it involves sitting on your balls.
I think you misinterpreted that.
No, you know, it literally does.
So I've got this lacrosse ball, which is called a lax ball, L-A-X ball. And it's about the size of a tennis ball, but it's hard.
So in English terms, we're thinking cricket ball.
Yeah, you could use a cricket ball easily. Any ball that's
hard. Could you use a golf ball?
You couldn't use a golf ball. Golf balls are pretty aggressive because it's
and very
a bit smaller.
Aren't
and they are very
okay.
hard. They have
so
no
we're looking
give.
At a thing the size of a cricket ball as a cure for back pain.
Yeah.
How does it do that?
So what I do is I put the ball on the ground and then I'll sit on it on one side. So you start with your left cheek or your right cheek, whichever one you want. And you're basically going to sit on it and put your weight on it. So you bring your knees up towards your chest. You keep your heels on the ground so you can mediate the weight a little bit. And then you're going to roll around and try and find the points in your glutes, which is your bum, which are tight. And basically, it's quite easy. The points at which are tighter are where it's going to hurt the most. So when it starts to hurt, you want to stay in that point for a bit and kind of try and work out that knot. So you're giving yourself a massage with this ball. Once you've done that, then you kind of shift, you can shift to your side, try and find some more points on the lateral side of the muscle. And then you change to the other glute and you try and liberate that other glute. And what that does is it takes a muscle, which is the biggest muscle in your body, which is your gluteus maximus, your bum. and it's very tight a lot of the time with lots of people, and it's just going to massage it and let it rest and let it take out some of its tension, which means that further up the chain in your lower back, that's going to be released, and you're going to release a lot of tension in your lower back as well.
Because back pain generally is deferred, isn't it, from the gluteal area?
Yeah, I find with my clients about 70 to 80% of people who suffer from back pain do not work their mobility in their glutes. They've got tight glutes and tight hamstrings.
So you pass them a lacrosse ball.
I give them a ball and I say, knock yourself out. Sit on that for 5 minutes and
right.
Tell me how you feel.
Right. Now, I can imagine quite how excruciating that must be, but I'm also looking forward to trying it. Don't have back pain at the moment, but as soon as I do, I will be sitting on a lacrosse ball or a cricket ball.
Or a lax ball.
Failing that, a golf ball. We're going to take a break now, and hopefully we're going to be back with Matthew Bennett.
TRE. Talk Radio Europe. At home with the Hogs. With Mr. and Mrs. Hogg.
Who are they? Let's turn to the political analyst who makes the indecipherable world of Spanish politics cipherable. Reviewing some of the standout themes of 2018 here in Spain, Matthew Bennett joins us from Murcia. Matthew, hello and happy greetings. Greetings of the season, or Felices Fiestas and all the rest of it.
Good morning, Kit and Penny and everybody. Merry Christmas to you.
Well, I've got something to tell you, Matthew, first of all. The heifer isn't with us, unfortunately, but I'm going to introduce you to my son, Koibi, who's...
Your son, Koibi?
Koibi, yeah, who lives in Barcelona, grew up here in Spain, and hopefully we'll be able to say something intelligent during the course of our in-depth study of 2018 in Spain. Do you think you will, Koibi?
Good morning, Matthew. I'll do my best. I think I'm going to represent the ignorant side of the coin.
Go for it, Koibi.
Grassroots.
Go for it.
Okay. Listen, man, as we look back at 2018, a starting point might be the King's Christmas speech, a message he delivered to the nation just a few days ago. I mean, before we talk about the actual content of the speech, we of course used to the Queen's speech being Brits. It's something you do after Christmas dinner at 3 o'clock on Christmas Day. How much import actually does the King's speech carry here in Spain?
I think it's a pretty similar level of importance, at least to some people in society, as the Queen's speech in England, 9 p.m. every Christmas Eve, as everybody's sitting down to the table, so they don't even have to wait until afterwards. When people might get up and go away to get some pudding or something, or a cup of coffee, 9 p.m. every Christmas. And I think over the period of the transition and Spain's modern young democracy, perhaps it's acquired a special bit of significance because it was the king every year talking to the nation and telling them how they were doing-ish.
Oh, I imagine during the transition it was absolutely pivotal because the king, in fact, was pivotal, wasn't he?
Juan Carlos,
you know, when he foiled the coup in 81. He was the main man, really. But
that's
now
right.
People still listen, do they? You think
about this? Well, I don't know, mate. Let's ask Koibi. How old is Koibi?
Koibi is
27.
Man, 27.
Thanks, Dad.
Okay, so it's an older young guy.
Yeah, he's a millennial.
I didn't watch the King, partly because I was at home. We don't have a telly, but a lot of my friends did, and I actually on Christmas Day received some messages saying, "Oh, we're just watching the King," which I thought was pretty bizarre.
Right, okay, that's good. All of the young people I ask about this never watch it, so that's interesting.
Oh right, well I must roll with quite an educated crowd.
I guess you are.
Or conventional crowd, conservative crowd, sort of PP voters. Let's talk about the content of the King's speech, because it's a starting point for our review of the year. Union. You identified on the Patreon that one of the themes of the speech was the union of the nation. Obviously, without mention of Catalonia. Catalonia was what he was thinking about.
Yeah, obviously he was making reference to it. So he talked about coexistence. They were always talking about union things, but the idea of the transition and the constitution as the basis for Spain's modern coexistence. and how that should be treasured, of course, beyond violence. But the implicit assertion there, of course, is that that same constitution, therefore, is threatened if it needs defending, if it's in danger of risk of erosion, then it's crumbling in some places, or it's being attacked from some places, and the obvious place it's crumbling and being attacked from is Catalonia.
Yes, the politics of separation.
Those 2 million separatist Spaniards don't want to be Spaniards anymore.
Yes, and obviously the king is doing all he can to cement the union. With regard to Catalonia and disregarding the king for a moment, are attitudes harder now than they were a year ago? Where do you think that's gone in the last 12 months?
I think it's still a big problem. It's a mess. It's a frustrating mess, I think, for the separatists themselves. They're not going forward with their plans. The way Pedro Sanchez and his socialist government are dealing with the problem is being described as either treasonous or at least highly incompetent by the right in Spain, but that same incompetence, possibly, is having the effect that it's dividing the Catalan separatists among themselves. So they're not advancing with their plan either. And if we look at what happened on the 21st of December, 3 days before Christmas, it was supposed to be the big set piece political battle, street battle, because the Spanish government, the central government, was going to hold a cabinet meeting in the very heart of old Barcelona.
Matthew, right. What was that about, actually? Is that normal, that the the cabinet... What was that about, that the cabinet should decide to meet in Barcelona? Does the cabinet ever meet anywhere other than Madrid? Was this a first?
It hasn't done, historically, and in the modern period it hasn't done either. But it was a suggestion that was floating about a couple of years ago as a way that the Spanish government might try to become closer or get closer to the regions and people in Spain who are outside of Madrid. It's not a bad idea. So in October, I think it was, they did a first one in Seville before the elections in Andalusia, which obviously had an electoral slant to it. And then they'd announced this cabinet meeting in Catalonia in Barcelona. I think the timing was probably wrong. They should have done it in June or July when everything was fresh and new and there hadn't been time to get frustrated.
Right, so it's a bit like a national football team playing matches in Valencia and so spreading it about a bit. Koibi, you want to say something?
And what was the goal of the separatist movement for that? Because I was actually in Barcelona for that day, and yeah. The whole city was being prepared for shutdown.
Right.
And actually, it was probably the easiest day that I ever had. There were no cars on the road, no roads were closed. It was super easy. It was awesome.
Good for the environment.
Yeah.
Pollution-free Barcelona. But
what were they trying to achieve that day?
Okay, the idea for that day was, do you remember what happened on October the 3rd last year when they shut Catalonia down with all of these roadblocks and they shut Catalonia down? There were over sort of 50 roadblocks 2 days after the vote and it was a mess. And then in that evening, there was the king's speech because it was so chaotic. So the 21st of December this year was supposed to be a repetition of that, basically. The idea was to shut Catalonia down again and create havoc because the Spanish government had the temerity to move physically right into the heart of separatist territory, right next to Parliament Park, right next to the headquarters of the regional government, where they have all of these big meetings. So the idea was to shut it down. So one of the things that you could have imagined was maybe they were going to surround the government in the place where they held the cabinet meeting. It would have been very, very bad for everybody, but in the end that didn't happen. They weren't capable of organising that chaos.
Mm. The other royal perception was, leaving Catalonia for the moment, was continuing youth unemployment. I mean, this is actually quite brave of the king to bring this up, because it's shameful, isn't it, that here in Spain, 10 years after the crash, we still have 33% youth unemployment.
Well, that was my first thought. So 10 years later, he recognises it. The king, the royal household, recognises that this is a problem.
No, but to say it publicly, to bring it up,
yeah,
is potentially potentially incendiary almost. I mean, it's normally, it's the sort of detail you'd actually want to sit on, cover up.
It's, yeah, maybe.
It smacks of honesty to bring it up, doesn't it?
Is it after 10 years? Everybody knows what's going on. Everybody knows the problem. I mean, people who were 8, I mean, 10 years, it's a long time. People who were 8 when the crisis started, they're now 18. And the other lot who were 18 then, like Corby, 27, 28 now. Where are their... I talk to lots of young people who don't really have a future in terms of an economic future. They can't form those families because those jobs aren't good enough and they don't pay enough, as the King said in his speech. So in that sense, he was right. But if we understand the implications of that message and those details, it means that the parents' generation, including him, haven't fixed it over that 10-year period.
And did he have any suggestions?
Did he?
Yes.
No. The transition.
Well, I suppose, really, it's not up to him to have the solutions, because he's a constitutional monarch. It's up to the politicians, isn't it?
Well,
it's
I
up to the government.
Yes, technically, but it's not like Queen Elizabeth in the UK. So nobody has a clue what Queen in the UK thinks about politics 60 years later. And when there was a slip a couple of years ago, wasn't there, with David Cameron, I think it was Michael Bloomberg, on a visit to London, and the cameras caught him saying something about the Queen's politics, which obviously he might know more about as the Prime Minister. But the cameras caught it. They caught the slip, and it was a big scandal because the Prime Minister had revealed something about the Queen's politics. Whereas here, every year and every time he speaks in public during the year, the King does get into politics a bit more, and his father played a more active role.
Oh yeah, obviously, as we've alluded to during the transition, and that's an interesting comparison, isn't it? That the King constitutionally can be more overtly political. Is possibly even expected to be more overtly political.
Yeah, to a degree, he's sort of expected to get his hands dirty a little bit with all of these things, isn't he? Because his father had a reputation of being a man who would do lots of talking behind closed doors to important people, and he would sort of fix things and smooth things over and nudge things left or right to make it all fit and work, whereas his son doesn't have that reputation because he's a son and he's not his father. And I think there's an interesting comparison between modern Spain in 2018 and the Spain of the transition in the 1970s and the King's son and the King father, if you like. So I think, I wonder if he's not trying too hard to be his dad when he gives these speeches. So you've got the formal setting of the palace every year with the Christmas speech and the tradition and the ceremony and all of that business. But the way he gives the speech, I listened to it this year for the first time. I was driving up for dinner with my son, and I listened to it on the radio, so I didn't see the setting until later, which is okay because it's always the same setting. Everybody talks about which photo's there and whether or not they've got a little statue of baby Jesus and all the rest of it, but the setting's basically the same. But I was listening to it on the radio, so I was just listening to the audio, and he sounded royally bored. There was no effort there. It was just, come on.
Right.
I was kind of rooting for him to go, come on, put some energy in it.
some dramatic poise or something.
Do something with this message. Yeah. And what do you care about, Your Majesty? What do you...
Yes, but Matthew, did he sound bolder than normal? I've heard little snippets of him, but...
No. He said, that's the point. He sounded as bored, as stultified as he always does.
Okay.
So I think he's formidably well educated himself. He's sort of part of that generation almost, of young Spaniards-ish. He's 50-something, isn't he? So, just 50 perhaps. So, he's not old. He's not that parents' generation. He's still a beneficiary of the transition, if you like. So I wonder if he couldn't be more within the limits of the royal family. And Spain's royal family is a very young institution still. It's not like the UK, where the Queen and her predecessors have been there for 350 years or something. In Spain, it's been a renewed institution only since 1975.
Okay, so if Felipe was listening, we'd say content 7 out of 10, delivery rapport could be improved, yeah? Exactly. Try and stir the blood, mate. Something like that.
Maybe you could innovate in the Christmas speech kit. I don't know. Maybe you could do something different. It could be a bit more lively. Maybe they could change the setting. Maybe
have some music going on.
You're saying he's a pecho frío.
Do a radio program with Kit or something. I don't know. But maybe he could do something.
He's a what, Kobe? Just a second, Matthew. Kobe was saying he's a pecho frío. He's a what?
Pecho frío.
Pecho frío.
Pecho frío is like you have no pride, you have no blood.
Right, that's it. So the thing that is at the bottom of this, I think, is what I was feeling the other night as I listened to the stulted, dull delivery, was what does this king, as opposed to his father, because everybody knew who his father was by the end, he was a bit of a character and he had his good points and his bad points, but he was clearly recognizable as Juan Carlos I. This guy, Felipe VI, who is he?
Was his father a good speaker?
We don't know who he is yet. We don't know what he cares about.
Okay, Juan Carlos, Matthew, was he a good speaker? Could he stir the blood?
I don't know if you'd say stir the blood.
Right.
Surely that's got to be, I mean, if we don't know who he is, I think that's just got to be a reflection of how less important monarchs are in the modern day.
It could be, or they could take it another way. So now we're in the era of Facebook and Twitter and social media and iPhones and all the rest of it. So the media and technology environment has changed completely to what it used to be. So maybe he could innovate like that too. And stirring delivery could be one rhetorical option. So the rhetorical option at the minute is royal boredom and sort of standard tradition and not saying anything in a very lively way.
And we're talking about leadership, really, aren't we? Do you think Spain lacks leadership? We 2018 saw the landmark for the eventual departure of Mariano Rajoy. No great loss there. We now have a king who can't apparently express himself, and Pedro Sanchez. Pedro Sanchez has had a remarkable year, but how secure will he be feeling right now?
No, I would say Spain does lack leadership for sure. The king could innovate there. He could do more there, I think, within the confines, within the limits of his constitutional role and continuing to be a king and be a very sort of formal, traditional thing. But there's lots he could do there if he wanted to.
More charisma is what we want, isn't it?
More charisma, more Felipe. Who is he? What does he want? What does he care about? What does he want for Spain while he's here?
Right.
I think the king's probably the only person who's actually got a chance to do that, because everyone seems so disenchanted with politics. And after Rajoy, Sanchez is, he's a flannel, isn't he? He's not a leader. They're just all really boring. And then apart from like Pablo Iglesias had a strong start, and now everyone's gone off him as well.
Right.
The king has got to be the only person who can actually take that role.
Right. Because if we think about the functions of leadership in a big organisation, it doesn't get much bigger than a country, does it? So if we think of the king as the apex leader of the nation, which is exactly what he is, and think about the functions of leadership at those levels, he doesn't have to worry so much about the how, but what he could do quite legitimately, and this would be innovative and regenerative, is to set out sort of big, bold visions for what he thinks Spain is and could become.
Yes, sort of inspirational visions. Of course, he has to tread carefully, doesn't he? Because he is within the bounds of a constitution. He's not an absolute monarch in any way. He's a constitutional monarch.
But he could do that by talking about Spain and Spanish and the Spanish nation and Spanish society. He doesn't have to get into politics so much. So at the minute, for example, with the separatist problem, there's this image of partial image of Spain. On the other side is this sort of all of the flag-waving nationalist Spaniards from last year, with these videos from last year. But Spain is so much more than that, historically and culturally and socially. And it has such a long, deep history that the king could dive right into all of that and demonstrate how proud he is of Spain and Spaniards.
Yes, Matthew, he could, couldn't he? He could inspire us with a vision of Spain, a little bit like the Remainers could have inspired us with a vision of Europe, which they absolutely failed to do. The king should inspire us with a vision of union, actually. It could be a glorious union rather than a sort of disparate amount of squabbling people.
I think he could. So just as one small example, yesterday I saw a story on Reuters, I think it was, about Spanish designers, fashion, clothes, And the story was some Spanish designers are now diving deeper back into that history to add sort of historical Spanish flourishes to their 2018 clothing ranges, which looked very nice. I mean, I don't understand very much about fashion and clothes, but it looked very nice. And I thought from an identity perspective, it was interesting that they were doing that, because fashion is perhaps not a realm where you normally associate national identity with.
Colby, final point.
Just with the king trying to kind of get passionate about being Spanish and all the rest of it. The thing that pops up to me is that nowadays in modern Spain, at least from my generation, if you're proud of being Spanish or like from the center of Spain and believe in Spain as a union, a lot of people will just label you as a fascist.
Castellano fascist.
Yeah, and that, I think that's a real problem, because now to be proud of being Spanish, does that mean that you're a fascist?
Well, exactly. So this stems from the lack of political leadership last year as well, during the separatist crisis, where the Spanish government then under Rajoy was completely absent from the narrative, promotional, propaganda debate in the world. So the separatists were there saying, fascist, 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 horrible Spanish people who rob us and are just all fascists.
Matthew, absolutely fascinating. We're going to have to leave it there. We haven't got half where I wanted to get to. We haven't nominated a Spaniard of the Year. We've talked intriguingly about the monarchy and leadership. Matthew Bennett, an intimate observer not only of the Spanish political scene, but of things Spanish in general, formerly of the Spain Report. Catch him now on the Patreon platform. A very happy new year to you. And
you
thanks
too,
for
guys.
Joining us. Bye-bye, man.
With the Hogs.
Welcome back. It's the fifth day of Christmas today, when my true love sent me, among other sundry turtle doves and geese a-laying, 5 gold rings. And isn't our idea of the perfect Yuletide landscape typified by that increasingly elusive commodity known as snow? Year in, year out, we listen to songs and carols that paint our world white. Let it snow, let it snow, let it snow. I'm dreaming of a white Christmas. Jingle bells. In the bleak midwinter, snow on snow, deep and crisp and even. All our TV ads invite us to join in. Families frolicking in foam and polystyrene, snow-shaped coloured solids, or rejoice, but on a with the entire population of an Arctic town in snowbound rapture as an ice road trucker arrives with a 40-foot Coca-Cola bottle, as though a siege has been lifted. All bask with Elton John in the glow of a John Lewis interior as snowflakes dust the window outside. Our Christmas cards and decorations embody ice-frosted totems from a glittering tundra, the eternal winter wonderland that is home to Santa Claus. These images are, of course, Christmas folklore, but the reality for most of us is very different. If you're going back to Blighty, drones notwithstanding, chances are your Christmas weather will be more of the same. Dreary, grey and muggy, alleviated only by gaudy Christmas jumpers. Unless you're in the Alps or Greenland, you won't have a white Christmas. And if you're here in Mediterranean Spain, unless you stand next to a snow machine on the Sierra Nevada, you won't have one either. But has it ever occurred to you that it just doesn't get any more Christmassy than the Mediterranean in December? At this time of year, the epoch of winter solstice, at evening on my way home, I try to park for a moment by the windmills, particularly when they hang their long blades motionless in a windless twilight. There I am, with my dog Brew, on a west-facing ridge, in an endeavour to rest a while in front of the drama of another convulsing sunset, fading now, sucked below the rim of the turning earth. But it is the moment just after this lurid drama of a sky in vortex like a convulsing volcano on its head, yet another jaw-dropping extravaganza of a sunset in December, but the moment that follows the twilight time, the subtle, sepiaed sequel to the drama, the second movement in the symphony of A Winter Evening. This is a magical moment of stillness and palpable sense of infinite space. It's the silhouette hour when canopies of pine, olive, and naked poplar etch themselves in jet black, skeletal in the foreground dusk, backdropped by mauve mountains, backlit by the residue of low winter light, diffuse in a landscape soaked in embers of apricot pink. The residue of a day now laced by long shadows bidding reluctant farewell as they melt into darkness. While to the west, the mountains are black silhouettes, the sky a pulse of fading oranges, morphing into violet and blue, and then deeper blue in the draining of the dying day. There's no twilight luminescence quite like that of a Mediterranean evening in December, when earth and sky hold their breath together in a stillness that tingles on the edge of something that echoes eternity. The trail of an airliner is a line of pink mascara reflecting the sun from another horizon. And it's at this time when headlights arc curved carreteras, when distant pueblos pimple and pop their first lights, that an evening star peeps shy from the mother of pearl azure, itself a nativity in the twilight zone of yet another night, of yet another year in this deep southern cradle of civilization. These are the Bible lands at Christmas, in the midst of which the great Mediterranean mother, heaving imperceptibly, while as placid as a mirror glass, reflects the deepening firmament. And who knows, on these nights in particular, the birth of a savior, the birth of a new year.
Home with the Hogs with Mr. and Mrs. Hogg.
Yes, it's lovely to have you here with us today. You are at Home with the Hogs on the Christmas and end of year special show. And we're delighted to welcome raconteur, writer and regular contributor to the programme, Matthew Wolfman. Matthew, hi. He's hot in from the first of your airport runs today. This is definitely a feature of this time of year, isn't it?
Yeah.
Which airport have you been to?
Well,
actually,
we went to Little Gibraltar, which I prefer, the Gib Airport. It's a little baby airport where, in this day, you can actually stand outside, whereas most airports, they're just giant shopping malls. So, Gib we like. Anyway,
when you do a Gib Airport run, do you cross the border or do you shovel people out at the border?
I shove them out at La Linea,
yes,
literally the line, the border, and they've got to make their way through the always non-working electronic passport control.
Right, with their wheelie bins.
With their wheelie, whatever they're wheeling. Yeah. Yeah, it's always straightforward. Right. It's always straightforward.
All right. Now, Matthew, what did you get for Christmas?
This year, it was so exciting.
What was it? Was it something you wanted?
It was all a surprise to me. Some people might sort of believe I'm a little bit of a Luddite. So a couple of my sons thought they'd shake me out of my aging shell. And I got a Fitbit watch thing, training app.
Fitbit. That sounds immediately irritating.
Which I have on at the moment.
Oh,
and
right,
if you
okay.
shake it, not only does it tell me the time, it tells me how far I've walked so far today, what my heart rate is. And at the moment, I seem to be walking at 2.3 kilometres, but I seem to be sitting here. So I'm not saying
it's obviously
all
monitoring
accurate.
Brain
What's your heart rate?
Or something?
My heart rate was 81 a minute ago. Oof. Is that high or low?
Well, you must be a bit excited to be on the radio.
82 now, it's gone up, yeah. Oh, no, it's gone down to 81.
Nerves, maybe.
It sort of marries to your smartphone. So you have the app on the smartphone. The whole smartphone always also tells you, I don't know, what your sleep patterns were, keeps your step count. It's all this sort of stuff that I suppose if you're young, you'd want to know about this.
Before you open that present, was it in your consciousness to want that item?
Well,
had you thought about buying it?
I'm a bit of a I'm not a tech phobe, to be honest. I already have, as people know, I do a lot of walking. I already use an app called Wikilock, wikilock.com. Follow it, you can download it, costs nothing. And it tracks all my walks and it uses GPS. And it's a great little app to use if you are walking in places you don't know, or if you want to find places to walk. If you happen to be somewhere, you can just look for walks on the Wikilock.
Does it give you a readout at the end of the month as to where you've been?
Wikilock, it traces every walk you make if you want to save them, and you have your own archive online in the cloud. So at the moment, I've got about 156 walks up there, which anyone can access if they just look for me, Matthew Wolfman.
Yes, because I've got something that reports to me. I don't know where it's come from. It happens on my mobile phone automatically at the end of every month. It tells me where I've been during this month. So it can tell me how many times I've been to Benal Madonna Costa, for example. It's riveting.
Now, someone's following you.
Slightly eerie, but it's also slightly depressing because it shows how entirely predictable and unadventurous my life is. I mean, I could use it as an incentive for travelling. Christmas presents. Do you ever get what you want, Coy?
Yeah, you do. I think when you were younger, because when you were younger, it was quite obvious what you wanted because you made it obvious. You stop by in a shop window and you go, oh, that's really cool football or something like that.
You could then, also, as a young person, become convulsed in disappointment.
Yeah. That's happened a few times.
Yeah. Like really, really shattered when you don't get what you want.
I don't actually remember that too much. I remember one birthday, not Christmas, but a birthday where I had a bike party. I used to be into riding bikes with friends and we had a digger down to build some jumps and the digger broke. And I remember that because that was like, oh, and I had all my mates over. But the digger was like the present sort of thing, but it actually broke. But it was the right thing. And we got it fixed in the end. But I think Christmas is kind of hopeful. This year I got lots of cleaning products. Lots of cleaning products. So all like moisturizers. No, not.
I thought you had. Bleach.
Well, I've got long hair liquid. Now as well. I've got some hair conditioner and lots of beard stuff. So, which is really nice. It's stuff I don't normally buy for myself.
Sorry, they're not called cleaning products. They're called grooming products.
Big packet of bleach. Right. Yeah. Oh, thanks, Mum.
Another thing that seems to happen during Christmas is that somebody's always ill. In your household this time, Matthew, you escaped?
No, I mean, we all survived. The only thing I suppose one or two of us suffer from were the so-called self-imposed sort of sicknesses brought on by rather excess consumption of vino tinto or vino blanco or brandies or what have you. But apart from that, we survived well, and we had fabulous walks because the weather, people in this part of Spain anyway, the weather has just been magical.
Blue skies. It's been gorgeous.
And on top of that, I know you were waxing lyrically earlier, but, you know, the narcissi are out, little vinegar, little oxalis, daisies are out, the gorse is beginning to flower. In our own place, the bignonia with those vast trumpet purple flowers, they're still banging out these flowers. And we've had some bees. A bit dangerous for them. We've had some bees out looking for pollen. I mean, it's quite extraordinary.
I absolutely resonate with the narcissi. Yeah. We were on the Atlantic coast. Well, you were with us.
Yeah,
coming
yeah.
back over the hill from Bologna towards Tarifa.
Magical.
Meadows of these beautiful little white flowers. Yeah. Absolutely fabulous. No, just going back to the inevitable Christmas cold, which I've been fighting, and my brother over there in Wales is so ill. He's been ill actually all month, but it was sort of deeply embedded cold.
You said it, Kit. Over in Wales.
And I was trying to outline the factors for illness at Christmas. And we're talking specifically about colds. And I think it is the time of year, particularly in the north, where you get that damp chill. That just can chill you to the marrow underneath a grey sky, sort of.
Yeah.
Yeah, in a day that's kind of lost interest in its own existence.
Yeah, I remember that. I used to live in Liverpool, and you'd wake up and pull the curtains back and nothing would change. The room would stay the same darkness. And I had mould growing in the corner of my room that would kind of get bigger every day. And the cold that's in your bones and you can't shift it.
The other factor, I think, is exhaustion. That we do tire ourselves out in the run-up to Christmas and in terms of the panic buying and the preparation and the goose fat and all the rest of it.
But also, if you remember, as a kid, the first semester or the first term, September through December, it's a very, very long term.
That's a long haul.
And it's a long haul. And the build-up to Christmas, certainly in Britain, because it's sort of promoted so early now, it just seems to drain you in a way. By the time you get to Christmas, certainly in my world, a new year, it's a sort of bit of a relief. And to be honest, I'm looking forward to Twelfth Night.
You're just looking forward to
and then it's over.
Back to normal. Yeah. Yes. And the other thing, though, I think about illness and Christmas is the sheer act of stopping, the letting go when it's all done and you're there. That also can be synonymous with letting down your defences. And